Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Apollo 11, sort of a deeper insight. And, you know, it's one of these things that you go and see it and you don't realise that you're going to, over the years, get more and more insight. And so just recently I went for Apollo 11 party. It was someone's birthday party, the Apollo 11 party forum. And there was this, he built a Lego model of the Saturn stuff, and he just had all this extra additional information that I didn't know. And we're at this Apollo 11 party, and we were at a live time watching a website which was streaming the Apollo 11 landing live, and we were just, it just didn't make sense, because I remember as a kid, as someone in kindergarten, I know it was grade one it was, at the school, and they brought in a TV and we watched it, and it's in Australia, and at the time I do remember it was after we were served milk. So what can I say, in the 70s we had these amazing things to do. Every child was given milk, because it was something throughout the British Empire that everyone had a glass of milk, because what had happened is that I think in the Zulu Wars and stuff like that, the British recruiting people said, look, the quality of British people are just too low, they're malnourished. And so they introduced automatic throughout the British Empire, every kid got milk. So there was these little bottles of milk, and you could drink them, and they had all the cream on them. And then there was the queen, a picture of the queen, and people, boys had to bow, and the girls had to curtsy before the queen. So this, thank goodness this is gone. It was there. You sort of didn't know. Now, you've still got this really stupid queen stuff is in scouting. I don't know what that's all about. Scouting, there's still vestiges of it occasionally, but that's all gone. So I was able to remember from these things, little things, roughly the time it came across. And I watched what I thought was the moon landing at 12:30 Australian time. But there was another thing, was that Australia was the only country pointing at the moon during the moon landing. So at that time, the United States was pointing to outer space, and Australia's pointing in. And it was a dramatic thing that Australia, with the help of NASA and a few backups, picked it up. And there's a bit of a folklore that the Australian radio telescope was pointed to pick up the moon landing. And so there's a Honeysuckle Creek, there's the NASA one, and there's a Commonwealth Government one. There's all this bit of legend around it. And United States had a rocket firing range in Australia, and it was part of the big space program. The fourth satellite in the world was launched from Australia. More of a scare tactic for the Soviet Union. So basically, believe it or not, I think the spy satellites, the US spy satellites, had to be, in the early days, had to be launched from Australia to fly over the top. So there's all this type of stuff. And I went to Adelaide University, which is just beneath the Rocket Range, years, you know, probably 20 years later, from it there, and all these rocket bits. And what was, I suppose, incredible is that you would pick up this rocket cone and it would weigh nothing because it was made out of titanium. And they still had the aluminium. It would machine too easily because it was rocket grade aluminium. And I must admit, I learnt a bit about point to point wiring and ruggedization of circuits from all of that. And we're getting back. We had. Burnt in the mind that the moon landing occurred Australian time in just after midday, and what they had in this US thing, that the moon landing was happening about 10 in the evening on it, and we were just scratching our heads, how could that possibly happen? So in this one I'm going to talk about the time zones and then start to talk about some of the amazing technology as we walk through all of this. Let's see the so we've got this problem that the moon landing occurred at 12:30, but 50 years later the website, which said it's to the second, is there. And so we were just really trying to work out, and there's a few web people, and we thought that perhaps we were trying to work out, because there's a time zone, there's a distance, was the website being fed, was the moon landing live and realistic for the US? And we had all the datelines working out what was going on. Was it accounting? What was it actually doing? So that was so hard to go. So I'll just try and talk through that in a little bit. Okay, so just starting it again, just to try and put it in. We've got this problem that we were being told that the moon landing was happening at a different time from when we could remember it. And we were just trying to actually work this out, because we're watching this in Australia. And so, was it that the website was wrong? Was it, you know, somehow getting Australian time and, you know, we were accessing it incorrect? Or was it the real time in the US? Was that 10:30? And we had discussions about sort of President Kennedy being assassinated, because that's another problem. Because I think in the US he gets assassinated on the 22nd, but it was the 23rd of November when I was born when he was actually shot. So you've got these things. We've got the dateline. It's so hard to work these things out. And so we were just really, really confused, and we tried to work out what was going on. And the actual simple answer is this, that what was televised was the moon landing, and the moon landing did happen at night in Australia, right? But it wasn't for a substantial time after that you had the moon walk. And what everyone did was look at Neil Armstrong have his first step on the moon, which happened at primetime US television time, given that it's 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening in the US. However, it happened at 12 o'clock in Australia, and the moon walk didn't go through Australia because Australia was pointing the wrong way at that time, because it was 12 o'clock and the moon was visible at that time. They wouldn't do a moon thing with a new moon. So the actual moonwalk, when we watch it, and then it all came out that there was this basic misunderstanding right throughout, just so dreadfully embedded between the moonwalk and the moon landing. So the moon landing did occur in Australian night, but or very early morning, but it wasn't until late morning Australian time that the stuff came off, and basically it landed while the US was pointing away, and it rotates, and the US had to rotate back so that Neil Armstrong would get out on time. And there's all this complexity. Now, little by little, we've, I suppose, learnt things, or I've had to teach this, and very much, when I was doing my HSC, I did all past papers, and you could, I did past papers through the 60s right up to 1980, so I did lots of past papers for my HSC, and so I got 99 or 100, or 100%, and what would happen, I did so many past papers, it would only take me a few minutes to roar through the paper, because I just did all the past papers, and doing the past papers, you could see the moon landing questions come up, you know, during that time, so I could relive that period of history through exam papers. Then I had to teach aspects of it, and different aspects of it, I don't know, it's various books which are wrong at various times, and so there was How It Works book from that era which said about the rock construction, and it had labelled the fuel inside the Saturn as hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, and that's what was taught in many Australian books. However, it took me a while later to go through it many times and realise that they had RGP, rocket grade propellant. This is ultra refined kerosene, and so this could burn with oxygen without the build up. So if you build you use normal kerosene, which is jet fuel, it will carb and destroy your thing. So the important thing is that the fuels were basically the same fuels as used by the Germans in World War II. It was a big V2. This is oxygen and kerosene to start off with, and that's a bright yellow flame. That made sense to me now, because the yellow comes from carbon soot in the burning going forward. So the carbon, you see the glow of carbon, whereas a hydrogen and oxygen flame is basically colourless. So that makes sense, and there's lots of things for it, and obviously you put the heaviest, cheapest fuel at the first stage with massive engines, and so that's the first thing, which is a correction. And then going through it, there's five engines, a central engine, and the bottom engines are gimbaled, and the gimbling of engines allows them to steer the rocket, detect where it's going over. So if the rocket's beginning to fold over, it then steers it back. It's like a pencil going up. It can go back and forth. So you need computer control of those gimbals, which is sort of pretty amazing, amazing stuff. And then if the engines go off, basically, say if you've got engine 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the center, if say 4 goes off, 1 and 3 will gimbal to the side to stop the rocket, to stabilize the rocket. So that's pretty interesting there. Now I suppose the other thing is that one of the things I didn't know is that the rocket used to, what it's called, pogo stick. So the rocket would take off and the inertia, the thrust, go through the rocket, travel up to the top of the rocket. The computers would slow things down and the rocket would resonate. It's called pogo sticking. Obviously they've got over it, but this is the vibration. So basically it was, they were hammered up into space coming across it. Now it took me bit by bit. I think it was Apollo 13 that I saw before I knew the lunar lander and the control step. I was watching that through Apollo 13 that I worked that stage out. So to say what happens is that you've got the well, I sort of should say that at the very top you've got the command module with rocket systems stage 3, which is the command module, and then fuel tanks and a rocket engine, and you've got the heat shield. Now the astronauts can't go further down the rocket than the heat shield, so that's stuck, and it goes up in the top. And so this is the very last cone, and then there's that long, very thin rocket at the top. So what's that rocket? And that's called the escape rocket. So what happens is Saturn goes up. Saturn rocket, Saturn V rocket goes up, which is sort of, I suppose, the scaling up of a V2 as opposed to the Russians, which basically got the V2 and made it bigger. They had 30 parallel rockets to go across, you know, insanely complex and expensive to do. However, this rocket, so this is the last little pointy bit on the rocket, and that pointy bit has the job only when the Saturn blows up. It will then pull the command module away from the explosion. So if the if it's all gone to pieces, they'll do explosive bolts, break off the third stage, and it will break off basically the command module and just drop everything else down. So I didn't understand it. So that long one, then it's got this gap, so it fires, and it fires sort of, you know, a vectored rocket to actually just pull that module off. So if it blew up on the landing pad, rather than just descend into the ball of flame, what would happen is these rockets would fire, and this little rocket would be enough to pull the command capsule away from the explosion. So quite an amazing thing. So underneath stage one was the lunar lander, which is slightly larger. And so when they get into orbit, they get the lunar lander out in space and vector thrust the command module around, dock with the lunar lander, and the lunar lander is sticking on the end of the command module, the pointy edge of the command module. So this is something, this is a pretty amazing feature of it. Now, I'm actually getting close to getting home now, so I better talk about the, I was absolutely, I said, it's not Dapto, it's, Dap, or Capon. Oh, there you go, Capon tape from the space program. I still loved, and thought it was interesting that that's the debris flying out as the tape. And it wasn't until I actually looked at the landing thing, it was sort of the party was there, and then 10 o'clock there was the then landing, and then we, that sudden sort of slow realization that our entire world was wrong. You know, what we thought was the lunar landing was actually the initial, you know, step out, you know. Okay, but they showed the lander, and you saw the fort. And when you saw the fort, you saw the fort actually had what looked like very light cardboard taped on, like a model. And in effect, it was. And this is sort of a realization that the entire thing was choreographed for as a propaganda thing. But, and you know, with the beam going out so you could see him go down, it was all, we want to see the person on the moon. And the actual lander feet had these bits of cardboard. I didn't see it until I had decided, I understood what that was. And so even when you look at it, everything's black and white, but you can see these little bits of gold, which is that tape, plastic tape, sticky tape. It is sticky tape. It's an adhesive, a vacuum-grade adhesive, and it doesn't outgas, and it's, you know, just great. But they have these little bits, these things which are obviously cosmetic, like bumper guards or, you know, bits of plastic on the outside. So the feet didn't look, it looked cool. And essentially, this is bizarre in that, no, the moon landing wasn't faked. It wasn't staged on Earth. It was staged on the moon with props and the sequence of things going on with the American flag and all that type of stuff. The planting of the flag and the, was it the saluting and all that stuff. And how I think the first one was Snoopy and Charlie Brown. You know, this was just, you know, the wrong way. It's just to really fine-tune it, tune it all up. But this is, for me, pretty interesting, that the lunar landing feet have these black shapes on it, and the black on it, and with the tape, is as if, you know, obviously it has no structural integrity. So this is, if it's sticky tape, it's obviously not for many hours of use. And besides that, it's, you know, obviously if you're sticking a piece of cardboard to the lunar module, and people, I'm sure the US people go, oh, no, no. And this is one of the great things you don't know. And so that kept on going in. A small thing about the capsule, the landing capsule, is it's got little inflatable beach balls, this set of beach balls which inflate at the top of it. And you know what would be the reason of that? Well, the reason is that when it lands in the ocean and it tips off the side, it will, the beach ball stop it going upside down. So there was two staple positions of it. So it increased the buoyancy at the top such that it would sit on the top there. And also it was sort of fairly light. And so that was a very interesting thing. What I don't quite understand is how the flotation raft came around the outside, because obviously it couldn't go through the heat shield. There was no obvious way for that. Now, there are these other things. If you look at the Saturn rocket between stage one and stage two, there's these eight tiny tubes, and the tiny tubes are those stage separation rockets. So when stage one is finished, it fires the rockets and makes this the stage two go away. So you see stage two go away, or the shield go away. So with stage one falls away, it's okay, and then you see the shield go away. So you see the other rocket sort of decelerate and go away. And this basically propels the rocket forward, but pushes the stages apart. So besides the stages, there's heaps of other little rockets, the escape rocket, the stage separation rockets, the boosters, and all that type of stuff. So this is going through, and if you realize it's 50 years after 50 years, I'm still learning about the pogo polling, the other rockets, some of the structures, and they're very tiny detail. And this is from someone building their Lego rocket, you know, really understanding it. And I made the comment that it's something which is very obviously easy to make out of paper. And indeed, we went to the website and you can get a paper Saturn V rocket, and my overall impression is that the Saturn V is up there with a wonder of the 19th century world. So I think we may say, because I really doubt that nuclear reactors will, I think nuclear reactors will die from the 20th century. Nuclear reactors would be a thing of the 20th century, and the Saturn V rocket is such an enormous achievement for its time, and so tall and so powerful in its context. Now, you know, today we can build pyramids and build dams and stuff. They're not wonders of the ancient world. So I would say the Saturn rocket, possibly Sydney Opera House, Sydney Harbour Bridge, Eiffel Tower. I'd put them all up there as wonders, as wonder of the world. Now, there's heaps and heaps of, I think, I don't know, things which are taught incorrectly. So, this is really interesting in that if you look at education as a code, there's sort of a research code which you run and you look for a small anomaly. But the education is so errorful that it's not a question of error trapping. It really needs a new culture. So what I want to say is one of the HSC questions, which is sort of devoid of content, why discuss re-entry, why it has to be between 4 and 6 degrees. 4 and 6 degrees is so that it doesn't bounce. If it's too steep, it will go cut into the atmosphere, heat up, and just go on a too steep entry. And if it's too shallow, it will actually just get some lift and bounce and change the orbit. And so it's there. And so you have these heaps of diagrams of the right angle, and then it going at almost as a projectile motion. Well, this is all okay. However, the actual Apollo did something, and it's different from the space shuttle. Space shuttle does this as well. They did various maneuvers. It goes in and bounces off and then re-enters. So what it does is it goes in at an angle, obviously too shallow an angle, first up, and then retro rockets a second time to actually plunge it in. So what happens is that it goes off, loses some speed, so it goes in, bounces, so it goes in through a bounce. And this particular piece of information is not taught. So I find it really interesting in terms of it's I suppose it's of scientific value, but it is a stage managed peak performance, like it was a stage show, and like a stage show, like you see the original, and after that you get copies of it. So this, you know, it was the great success was that it peaked very early, and subsequent things they were just running their thumbs. I think it took 4% of the US economy at some stage and $300 billion to build. So that was just basically print as much money as possible. We're going to do it. This is pretty amazing. A president, which is really vacuous, makes a speech at Rice University in front of two football teams and says, three times, we choose to go to the moon. It's a bit like it's had a religious going, and then he gets shot. And of course, the Americans get, you know, this is, you know, people are basically always fighting democracy to try and set the taps, this set the money taps on. So they went in for it. Good on you, America, for doing it. And it sort of kicked us forward into a future world. But it's a fundamental a cultural ritual. It was sort of an outer space ritual. It's also interesting to see the other rituals of various rituals we have, of the control room, people hugging each other, the tension on Earth, the interpreters, the rituals of was the Soviets and Americans meeting each other. It's a very much thing. And of course, the detailed science gets lost on. Now, I have a little children's book I was given about astronauts go to the moon, and it's, you know, beautiful, they'll come back and stuff like that. Thanks a lot for listening, and I hope this is a reasonably good podcast.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.